His deepest need was that people should like him. An admirable trait that, in a spaniel or a whore, not, I think, in a prime minister. And we've done him a favour too, if he did but know it. He was in the trap, and screaming from the moment he took office. We've simply put the poor bastard out of his agony. After life's fitful fever, he sleeps well. So let's not involve ourselves in any squeamishness, all right? Because this is just the start. That, Dominic Sambrook, was Francis Urquhart, Chief Whip.
That was chilling. That was absolutely chilling.
As played by Ian Richardson in the BBC 1990 drama House of Cards, which was screened at exactly the moment that Mrs. Thatcher was being defenestrated by the Tory party. And the reason that I've used that as an introduction, and the reason that we're doing this special Rest is History episode, is because the Tory party is engaged, it seems, in another process of regicide. So we are recording this at 9:15 on Monday the 6th of June, and 15 minutes ago, the results of a vote of confidence on the Prime Minister Boris Johnson were announced, and he won it, but kind of not brilliantly.
Yeah, 2-1-1. He won 2-1-1, 211 votes, and 148 Tory MPs said they had no confidence in him. So that's 41% of his parliamentary party said they didn't have confidence in him. And for context, that's the worst performance, I think, by a Conservative leader in a confidence vote in my lifetime. So it's worse, crucially, than Theresa May, his predecessor, in 2019, because she won 200 votes with 117 against. So the percentages were in her favour relative to Boris Johnson. So he is, you know, with 4 out of 10 Tory MPs lacking confidence in him, he is, shall we say, at the very least, grievously wounded.
Well, Dominic, I have a metaphor here drawn from the world of natural history, which I know you're a big fan of.
Big fan.
So Komodo dragons, the world's largest lizard, they have incredibly toxic teeth and breath and tongues. And all they have to do is give, a passing mammal, a deer or whatever, a little nip, and all the bacteria get to work. And then the Komodo just kind of follows the deer. The deer slowly gets more and more sick, and then it collapses, and then the Komodo dragon eats it. So
who's the Komodo dragon? Jeremy Hunt in this analogy.
I suppose the Tory party, I guess.
Yes.
So I think this result does justify perhaps looking at the history of prime ministerial downfalls.
Definitely. Definitely.
And I've been in the library all day looking at the murder of Caesars and things, but British prime ministers as well.
Very appropriate.
Very appropriate. But you have been drawing up your list of the top 10 prime ministerial defenestrations. Because obviously most prime ministers, by and large, resign because they've lost an election.
Exactly. Or they retire. Sort of Stanley Baldwin style. But you're right. There are two ways that people normally go. Either they go like Stanley Baldwin, so they retire at a time of their own choosing. That's pretty rare. That Gladstone as well, I suppose you would say. Or they are defeated. They lose an election, and then that's the end of their premierships. So that's what you might call the Jim Callaghan model, or the John Major, or Gordon Brown. But obviously, the most enjoyable ones, as your House of Cards analogy suggests, the most enjoyable ones are the regicides, the internal party coups. And anybody who was alive in 1990 who remembers that amazing symbiosis,
it was
the Thatcher downfall on the news and House of Cards playing at exactly that point.
I just watched the opening again.
Yeah.
And it opens with Francis Urquhart sitting in the Whip's office looking at a picture of Mrs. Thatcher and then kind of saying all careers must end and flat on the table.
Yeah.
And this went out at exactly the time she was resigned.
Extraordinary timing.
Extraordinary serendipity.
Although it's not serendipity, though. That's the interesting thing, because there was a sense at the end of the 1980s that Mrs. Thatcher's race was run. And I think there's that sense of gathering momentum. There's that sense that in Westminster, the tide has turned against you. You know, you see it reflected in the pages of the newspapers day after day. And everybody knows. It's like the sort of the end of, you know, a season of Game of Thrones, when everybody knows so-and-so's head is going to fall.
A quickening in the Praetorian camp.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. So that being so, you've drawn up your list, top 10.
Yeah.
What is your first one?
So the
Are
first
we going to do this chronologically, right?
Yeah, let's do it chronologically. The first one is the first one. So it's Sir Robert Walpole, So Robert Walpole, as most of our listeners will know, the first prime minister, he becomes prime minister in 1721. So he's been by 1742, he's been Prime Minister, Tom, for more than 20 years. He's a great character. He's quite Boris Johnsonian. So he's very earthy, and he makes a virtue of his kind of his humanity. And he sort of says he's no, you know, he's no Puritan.
No,
he's no, yeah, he's no reformer or all this sort of thing. He's incredibly corrupt. He's basically, he has made Britain rich, but he's also kept Britain out of foreign wars, which has upset a lot of people, the so-called Patriot Whigs. And there's a definite sense, I think, by the beginning of the 1740s that, you know, he's old, the momentum has moved, turned against him. He is forced, slightly against his will, to get Britain into war with Spain in the War of Jenkins's Ear.
Right, yes.
Which you may remember from our episode. You may remember from our episode on weird wars.
Yeah. So Jenkins was a British merchant who'd had his ear chopped off, supposedly by the Spanish, years before, wasn't it?
Absolutely disgraceful Spanish behaviour, which was obviously the pretext for this war, basically, because, you know, we wanted to supplant Spain in the Caribbean and so on. But that doesn't go terribly well. So we'd lost the Battle of Cartagena in 1741. And here's the interesting thing that sets a bit of a sort of template. So in January 1742, there was a move in Parliament to have a commission to investigate the handling of the war. And that was basically seen, that's an attack, a full-scale attack on Walpole, because Walpole is administering the war. And that was defeated by only 3 votes.
Okay.
So in a way,
a pyrrhic victory.
That's what so often happens in these stories. You get a pyrrhic victory, and then just a little later, the final blow kind of falls. And that's exactly what happened. And the sort of Komodo dragon in this, the sort of final blow of the Komodo dragon in this case, is it's very bizarre. It's an argument about a by-election in Chippenham. So that's one of the weird things about old political history, is that often the sort of the trigger is the most banal. And
but by-elections, I mean, you know, so hanging over Boris Johnson now are the results of the two by-elections coming up in the Red Wall and in the Tory heartland. So actually by-elections are a kind of crucial markers of political health, aren't they?
So what had happened is that in 1741, there had been a general election, which as so often happened in those days, took about 18 months or something. There had been a general election, and Chippenham had 2 seats, had 2 MPs, you know, obviously Manchester or Birmingham have none. But Chippenham has 2. So Chippenham had 2, and they'd both been won by the opposition, by sort of patriots or Tories. And the government, 2 government candidates said they'd been very hard done by and it had been rigged and all this sort of thing. And in the end of January, there was a vote in the House of Commons to sort of have to throw out the Chippenham MPs and to have by-elections, which the government hoped they would win. And it became a confidence measure, and Walpole lost it. Do you know how many votes he lost it by, Tom?
No.
He lost it by 1.
Oh.
By 1 vote. Oh. 235, 236, that was the result.
And if he'd won it by 1, would he have staggered on?
No, he was toast anyway. Because that thing had happened. James Callaghan had a metaphor in 1979, very famously, just before he lost to Margaret Thatcher. He said, there are times in politics when there's a sea change, and no matter what you do, you know, as prime minister, the tide is against you. And clearly for Walpole, the tide was against him. So he resigned about 10 days later. George II burst into tears when
I wonder
Walpole
if the Queen
resigned.
Will do the same when...
Well, when Boris... Maybe.
Too busy eating marmalade sandwiches. And
Walpole was given a pension of £4,000 a year, which was a colossal, just an astronomical amount of money.
He went off and bought gorgeous art, didn't he? Which then he died by Catherine the Great.
He died quite soon afterwards. I can't actually remember how long afterwards, but it was quite soon afterwards anyway. And do you know who succeeded him, Tom? I know you're very familiar with our second Prime Minister.
Can't remember.
I had to look it up. I don't think anybody listening to this will know. It was the Earl of Wilmington.
The Earl of Wilmington, of course. Yes.
A name to conjure with.
Yes. Okay, so Walpole, as in so many things, blazes the path.
Yes.
Sets the template. So that's number one. Number two?
So number two is a prime minister who is often regarded as one of our worst, absolute worst prime ministers. And American listeners, whenever we talk about prime ministers, would always say on Twitter, well, obviously your worst was Lord North.
Lord North, yeah.
Do you know, I discovered while researching this that Lord North wasn't actually his official title.
It wasn't.
It was only a sort of courtesy title, and his real title was the Earl of Guildford.
Well, Guildford got off luckily there.
It did. So Lord North, like Walpole, had been in a very, very long time. So he'd been in since 1770, so we're into the reign of George III now. It's now 1782. The most famous thing of Lord North, obviously, he completely fails to conciliate the American colonies and basically presides over the American War of Independence, which goes very badly. And this is an interesting one because Lord North is clearly not personally solely responsible for the loss of the American colonies, but he's a good example of the way in which a particular individual who appears to have been kind of effortlessly all-conquering can become this sort of totem, the sacrificial lamb. I'm mixing my metaphors horrendously here, but
I mean, it's a humiliating collapse. I mean, it's a humiliating blow to British prestige. It's the collapse of his foreign policy. So,
it is, yeah.
And if he's had an effortless rise, you could conceivably compare him to Anthony Eden, I know he doesn't resign immediately after the Suez Crisis, but he kind of goes off and has a recuperative holiday in the Caribbean, doesn't he? But then he resigns. And David Cameron.
Well, I was going to say David Cameron might not be a bad analogy, but I think David Cameron is quite similar in the sense that there's this sort of effortlessness and this sort of chillaxing, which at first people thought of as a refreshing change after Gordon Brown throwing remote controls at people or whatever and biting his nails, but then becomes a stick with which to beat him. Well, Lord North, he's also accused of being sort of indolent and sort of...
Well, Cameron and Lord North have quite similar faces. I mean, kind of...
Well, this is the thing with Lord North.
Rubiconed and round.
This is the thing with Lord North. Lord North looks like a very fat child in a wig. He's really not flattered by his portrait. And the weird thing is that actually, I believe the consensus among those historians who still do 18th century political history is that Lord North was actually quite a good prime minister.
He was all right.
And the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography says no prime minister in our history has ever had such command of parliament. He was a sort of financial wizard and very popular and all this sort of thing.
Cameron also had a kind of aura of, I mean, he commanded the house and...
He did, yeah.
He did. I think that's regarded as a...
He looked like a man who could never lose, and then he did.
And then he spectacularly did, yeah.
Yes.
Okay,
So what happens with Lord North is the British have surrendered at Yorktown in October 1781. The war is quite clearly lost, not least because of French intervention, which makes it really impossible to keep sending troops to North America. But the war has always been opposed. I mean, that's one thing that we often forget about the American Civil War, is there are lots of people in Britain who actually... There are quite a lot of people who actually support the Americans because they don't regard them as foreigners. They regard it as a kind of almost a British civil war. At the end of February 1782, there's a motion to end further prosecution of the war in North America. And this is basically equivalent of your Walpole Chippenham vote. And Lord North loses that vote by 234 to 215 in the House of Commons. And that basically... is the end of him. So he, again, in that sort of rather strange way that happens with sort of early British political history, there's then a sort of, the resignation which you would expect to come the next day actually comes a month later. So there's a lot of sort of faffing around.
So he takes longer than Cameron.
There's a lot of hanging around and presumably sort of gambling, port drinking.
Well, that's more Anthony Eden. Though.
Betting on hot air balloons, whatever.
Yes, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Whatever people but doesn't, got
doesn't,
up to.
Doesn't Lord North make a slight comeback?
He does. Yes, he does make a bit of a comeback, actually. So he's still involved in senior politics years afterwards. He succeeded. So the baton passes to the people who had supported the Americans, basically, who had been against the war. So first to Lord Rockingham and then to Lord Shelburne. But North hangs around for a bit afterwards. He's not completely discredited. So in that sense, he's Sir Alec Douglas Hume, Tom.
Very good. Yes.
That's your Lord North analogy. Yeah.
Okay, so that's Lord North. And then your third choice is actually the one that I thought of immediately, because, of course, you know, you could stop being prime minister not just because you've lost a vote of confidence or whatever, but because you're dead.
Yes.
So your third one is the only British prime minister to have been assassinated, Spencer Perceval.
Spencer Perceval. Again, a man who's slightly... hard done by his portrait, I think, because if you look at Spencer Perceval, he looks incredibly boring. And I think actually he was incredibly boring. So he would get sort of points today because he was a great abolitionist. He was opposed to the to slavery.
But it doesn't stop him. He gets murdered by an irate Scouser, doesn't he?
He does. So he'd been prime minister for 2.5 years. He was a Pittite. So he's a disciple of William Pitt, very much a friend of the rest of his history.
So Pitt also, I mean, he dies in office.
He does indeed.
So that's another.
Through gout, ulcers, and being a three-bottle man.
Yes, he's drinking, or is it claret he gets prescribed?
I think it was port, wasn't it?
It was port, wasn't it?
Three bottles of port a day in order to deal with his ulcers and his gout.
And his alcoholism, prescribed by his doctor.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Great days.
So Sir Percival, who's a very boring man, well, actually Pip was quite chilly, apart from the drinking, but Spencer Percival seems quite a boring man, although he does have 12 children, aged between 3 and 20. At the time of his death, which is quite a family holiday. Anyway, he's been prime minister. He's not terribly interesting. Obviously, we're in the Napoleonic Wars. There's a lot of, partly because of the war, or largely because of the wars, the economy is in a bad way. There's lots of unemployment. There's lots of industrial unrest in the north. Luddism, the Luddites, are in full cry.
So they're indignant weavers smashing up looms,
exactly. Yeah. So Spencer Percival is on his way to a parliamentary committee to investigate the Luddites. And on the 11th of May, 1812, and he goes into the House of Commons lobby, and a man called John Bellingham is there. Now, John Bellingham, as you describe him, an indignant scouter. John Bellingham is a failed merchant who's been imprisoned for bankruptcy in Russia.
For five years or something, wasn't it?
Yeah,
I mean, a long time.
For a long time, but he believes that the British government should compensate him.
Yeah.
For his, because he blames Britain's sort of, he thinks it's our fault for all our sort of orders and council and stuff that have been restricting trade, and that he's a victim of our Napoleonic War policy. And he went along to the Foreign Office a few days before and said he was in a great state about this, and Spencer Percival personally should be compensating him. And the bloke at the Foreign Office said, "You must do whatever you think best." So Bellingham went out and got a gun. And anyway, he shoots Spencer Percival. Do you know what Spencer Percival's last words were, Tom?
"I've been murdered."
Yes. He said,
I do. So I, yeah, but isn't, I mean, isn't it?
It's very Shakespearean. I'm slain, kind of.
But isn't Bellingham's motive, as I remember, is that he shoots Percival because he wants an opportunity to make his case?
Well, that's partly.
So he will be accused, and then he can stand up in the dock and say, "You all owe me money." which is a, you know, it's high risk, definitely a high risk policy, but original.
Well, this is the thing, because Bellingham doesn't. There's so much consternation when Spencer Percival has been shot and is shouting, "I've been murdered," and people are sort of milling around and stuff. And onlookers said Bellingham could have just walked out of the lobby.
Yeah, he just sits there.
But he doesn't. He sits down on a bench,
and he's got another loaded pistol with him.
And clearly, is very keen to be, and when he then goes on trial a few days later, he sort of, as you say, Tom, he makes a great point of saying, "Well, you know, I'm the real victim. I've been incredibly badly hard done by because my Russian business is." I mean, actually, Dominic Cummings had a business in Russia.
I'll tell you how I know about this is that Lord Byron hears about it, because he's obviously in the House of Lords. So he hears about it, and he goes off and he goes to a dinner party where Wordsworth is. And it's the first time that Byron and Wordsworth have met. And Byron bursts in and says the Prime Minister's been shot. So it's the first time that Wordsworth and Byron meet, and they kind of bond over.
That's a good fact, Tom.
Over them, and then they have a massive bust up afterwards. But
there's a great book in that, isn't there?
Yeah,
Spencer
there is,
Percival,
yeah.
John Bellingham, Byron, Wordsworth.
Wordsworth, it's all there. It's all happening.
It's all there.
Okay,
all human life.
So death is obviously a very, very dramatic way.
That's an outlier, though, isn't it? That is an outlier.
Okay, so much more common is some spectacular parliamentary bust-up, which is precisely what we get with your fourth choice, who is actually a friend of Lord Byron. So continuing the Byronic theme, Robert Peel, who was at Harrow with Byron.
Of course he was. So Robert Peel, he's twice Prime Minister, 1830s and 1840s, son of a manufacturer, so he's the first kind of industrial representative of industrial England, of the Industrial Revolution, to be Prime Minister. Born in Bury and then Tamworth, grows up in Tamworth. We discussed before, didn't we, whether he would have had, there's some discussion about Robert Peel's accent, whether he had a sort of Staffordshire accent, which I like to think he did. But he's the sort of founding father in some ways of liberal conservatism with his Tamworth Manifesto of 1834, which said, we just shouldn't be mindless ultra-reactionaries.
Yes.
We should try and accommodate sometimes
just
to the modern
world.
Just
be kind.
Yeah, well, I don't know whether he's quite be kind. He's all about EDI, is Robert Peel. Anyway, so Robert Peel, his big thing is that, he really is the sort of Jeremy Hunt of his day, because he's much more emollient than some Tories. And his big sort of trans, I mean, he has...
Does he have a fully sprung ballroom, which is what Jeremy Hunt has?
A fully sprung ballroom?
Yeah, at his house. Jeremy Hunt is rich. He has his own ballroom, fully sprung. He's a very, very keen ballroom dancer.
I can well believe he's a ballroom dancer.
Yes, very good on Strictly, very smooth.
Well, maybe anyway, if this business doesn't work out for him, then Strictly yes. awaits. Actually, Boris Johnson is such a Strictly wannabe, isn't he?
Yeah, but he'd never get past Evening Round now, would he?
Well, he might be a sort of John Sargent and Whittacombe type.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think so.
Anyway,
let's stick to Robert Peel. Sorry.
Yeah. So Robert Peel, yes, he's had two sort of semi-conversions. One is on Catholic emancipation, which he's become a believer in. And the other is the classic one, is the Tory party was the party of protectionism, of trade barriers to stop cheap food coming in to
destroying England's green and pleasant land.
To protect landowners' interests. And Peel, partly because of the Great Famine in Ireland, but also because obviously there's a huge demand for sort of cheap food from the growing cities, he decides that Britain has to change, that it has to ditch the Corn Laws and embrace free trade. And what he basically does, I mean, in some ways, the parallel, I suppose, that people sometimes give is Theresa May. So we'll come to Theresa May later, but she's caught between two wings of the party and sort of ground between these two great millstones. And that basically is what happens with Peel, except the difference is that Theresa May slightly refused to choose, whereas Peel basically does choose and abandons the sort of right of his party.
Also, I mean, Peel is an incredibly charismatic and eloquent man.
Is he that charismatic, though?
Yes, I think he is. I think he is. I think people really admire him.
They do admire him, but I think they respect him more than they love him, if you know. Do you not think?
I don't know. You'd know better than me, but I always had the impression. Byron certainly thought he was a wonderful man. And I think Byron wasn't easily impressed.
I think Byron is misleading you, Tom.
Maybe. Could be. I mean, he misled a lot of people.
Byron's vampiric ways of...
yes, maybe. Maybe that's it.
Anyway, yes. Yeah, so basically... By February 1846, Peel has said, let's ditch the Corn Laws, let's have free trade. 231 of his own MPs turn against Robert Peel. I mean, that really is a rebellion. And to get the repeal of the Corn Laws through, he has to rely basically on Whig and radical votes. So he's basically no longer dependent in any meaningful way upon his own party. But his political capital is hemorrhaging all the time. And the most famous moment, which you alluded to, was the 15th of May, when there's this absolute, which I reread today, this absolutely blazing attack on him by the young Benjamin Disraeli, who at that point is very reactionary. This is one of those things that, you know, you sort of read, oh, this blazing parliamentary performance, and then you actually read it,
and it's just a bit limp.
It's just dull as ditch water. So he accused Peel of huckstering tyranny. He said he was a burglar of other people's intellect. He said, if you scour the records from the days of the conquest, there is no statesman who has committed political petty larceny on such
a scale. That's great, isn't it? I love Disraeli.
So this kind of made Disraeli's name as this sort of great flamboyant orator. It basically just, everyone laughs and everyone has a whale of a time, and Peel is sunk, basically. So Peel survives for just over another month, and then he's defeated again over one of these bills that's sort of subsequently forgotten. So it's an Irish coercion bill, which is about sort of law and order in Ireland. He's defeated on that, and that is the end of him.
So he's another example of, this is another kind of Komodo dragon.
It is, scenario. Exactly, because he's limping on. Peel is limping on for the best part of 6 months, but he is finished. It's clear that he cannot continue. He falls off his horse. Very soon afterwards, Disraeli, of course, eventually becomes prime minister and steals all Peel's ideas. So
yes, and so, I mean, in a way, obliquely, he's destroyed by tensions within the United Kingdom between the constituent parts.
Ireland, yeah.
So people being kind of brought down by arguments over what the relationship of Ireland to Great Britain should be. This is then
that runs
through the rest of the 19th century.
But with Peel, I think you can argue that Peel's slightly brought down by his own integrity, by his own principle. I don't think that's something that people will say about our current Prime Minister Tom. Whatever they think of him, they won't say that Boris Johnson was a man toppled by his
Gladstone is basically destroyed by Ireland as well, isn't he?
He's not destroyed.
He resigns over it.
Not ultimately. So he does, you're right, that one of his premierships, I mean, Gladstone has... I think four premierships.
Yeah.
I think it's his third one. Yeah. But he does have a comeback in the 1890s when he's aged 380.
So maybe Boris can look forward to that.
Yeah, exactly. I think Boris and Gladstone are the two most unlike prime ministers. Yes.
Well, so yes, okay. So our fifth on the topic of people who are actually quite like Boris.
Yeah.
So your fifth is Asquith.
Yeah, Herbert Asquith.
Prime Minister in the first half of the First World War, who was brought down by a very Boris-esque character.
A very Boris-esque character. So Asquith, who's very much he's a friend of certainly this half of the rest is history. Asquith is a man who famously personifies the effortless superiority of the Balliol man, Tom, which I know you'll enjoy that reference. Asquith has been Prime Minister since 1908. He has presided over all kinds of reforms.
He's a very well-dressed man, isn't he?
He's very well turned out at the beginning, but he's distinctly shabby, I would say, at the end.
Is it? And he has unfortunate.
Well, his clothes are still, but he's obviously drinking a lot, Asquith.
So, and having unsuitable relationships.
Yes, and writing letters to girls and having picnics with people too young to be picnicking with. And reading novels
like
during
President
battles. And there were claims also that Asquith was a little bit handsy. But I don't know whether that's true or not. I mean, certainly by comparison with Lloyd George, Asquith is an absolute
So Lloyd George is basically Asquith's deputy.
Yes, he's his chancellor. He's his right-hand man. He's the radical firebrand.
The Welsh wizard.
The author of the People's Budgets in the Edwardian period. The sort of scourge of the Tories and the dukes and the upper classes. And they've been running the government, but they've obviously taken Britain into the First World War in 1914. In May 1915, they have had to form a coalition with the Tories because they've been attacked for not having enough shells and for making a mess of Gallipoli and stuff like that. So Asquith, in 1915, 1916, his authority really, I would say, is leaking away almost daily. You know, by inviting the Tories in.
Do you say like air from a Zeppelin?
I would say like air from a Zeppelin, Tom. That's a very nice. That's a very nice parallel. He's had to accept things that his heart isn't in. For example, conscription at the beginning of 1916.
Yeah, not liberal.
It's not liberal exactly. So the Liberal Party and the Liberal Creed is kind of crumbling under the pressure of the First World War. So in that sense, it's a little bit like Peel. He's sort of trapped in this situation where the tectonic plates are shifting. And he's going to end up the victim of it. But actually what happens, he really is completely and utterly stabbed in the back because Lloyd George conspires with the Tories and with the press lords, as they were called. So that's Lord Northcliffe, Lord Rothermere, and Lord Beaverbrook, as he became, I think. They have a little plot that basically they'll keep Asquith on as an impotent figurehead and that Lloyd George will really run the government through a war council. And they basically present this to Asquith. Asquith doesn't like it, not surprisingly. Lloyd George walks out, says, I won't serve under you. Then, you know, I'm out, knowing really that the Tories will back him, Lloyd George. Asquith can't lead a government without Lloyd George or without the Tories, or the Unionists, as they were called. So that's the end of Asquith has to resign. And Lloyd George then becomes Prime Minister with Tory support. And that destroys the Liberal Party. From that point onward. So Lloyd George, who is an absolutely, I've said it before, I'll say it again, he is an absolutely terrible man. Mm. I know the Welsh listeners to the rest of his history, of whom there are millions, don't like this claim. But Lloyd George, he sold out all his principles. He was a dreadful, I mean, he makes Boris look positively uxorious.
Yeah, so absolutely accepting that. But he was a more effective war leader, wasn't he, than...
Well, jury's a tiny bit out on that. So it's always been said that he's the man who won the war, that he, through ruthless determination and his peerless chairing of committees.
and his mighty moustache.
Yeah, he leads Britain to victory.
That's what Hemingway thought, wasn't it?
But there
Hemingway
are,
was a big fan.
Yeah, but people who like great men and people who fancy, who sort of get off on the idea of titanic men of ruthless vigour. Yeah. Sort of Churchill, Napoleon kind of people. Basically, Andrew Roberts. People like that, they love Lloyd George and they look at Asquith and they say, what a simpering old fool, you know, reading novels and talking
to
girls.
Gardens and things.
Yeah. So, but actually, Asquith was a perfectly good prime minister.
But the theme, the theme there is rivalries within the same party.
Yeah, being
which
knifed
I guess
your...
is kind of happening in the 18th century, but I'm not aware of it to the same extent. And it's there with, is it there with Disraeli or is Disraeli seizing his chance to make a name for himself?
Well, Disraeli is the classic greasy pole.
But Lloyd George and Asquith, is the classic Prime Minister and Chancellor of the Exchequer relationship, yeah, which throughout the 20th century has, you know, been an absolute breeding ground for rivalry.
I would say, yes, there's that. And I would also say, beware the mountebank. Because Disraeli, Lloyd George and Boris Johnson are all prime specimens of the sort of the flamboyant parliamentary mountebank, who the public love. They think their mountebanks are tremendous characters.
Yeah.
But of course, Boris basically did to Theresa May what Lloyd George had done to her. I mean, he wasn't her chancellor, but he flounced out, didn't he?
It is a theme, and I can see your list. It's going to come up again. But the relationship between 10 Downing Street, where the Prime Minister lives, and 11 Downing Street, where the Chancellor of the Exchequer lives,
it's incendiary.
It breeds rivalry.
So what would destroy Boris Johnson right now is if Rishi Sunak came out and said, enough is enough. You know, the Prime Minister has been sent a very clear message.
Well, maybe he's already said it. I'm out of here. We don't know what's happening while we're...
We're like trapped in a bubble, aren't we? I mean... yeah.
It's like the Big Brother house.
Yeah, it is. It's just
Love Island is starting tonight, Dominic. It's like we're trapped on the Love Island.
The tragedy of this, not just for the country, but for the world, is that we've had to postpone our planned podcast about history's greatest Love Island couples because we've been too busy thinking about footling business of prime ministers.
I know. Anyway, so I think we should go and take a break now. I might pop down and see what's happening on Love Island. Katie will give me an update, my daughter.
Okay.
You can find out what's happening in Downing Street. And when we come back, it will be to look at another prime minister who was toppled during a world war.
Exciting.
I'm sure you can guess who it is, but we will confirm it when we get back.
See you in a minute.
Hello, welcome back. We are recording this on a historic evening, Monday, the 6th of June. And Dominic, during the break, I popped down and discovered that Michael Owen's daughter apparently has just shacked up with someone. So that's very exciting.
This is on Love Island. That's exciting.
On Love Island. And Boris Johnson has announced that his disastrous result was extremely positive, decisive, and conclusive. So it's all happening. It's all kicking off. So you've given us five of your top 10. Yeah. We've had Walpole, we've had Lord North, we've had Spencer Percival, we've had Peel, and we've had Asquith. So we've got five to go. Number six, Neville Chamberlain.
So number six is Neville Chamberlain. So if you just think about those five, Walpole and Lord North are kind of the same story. They've had their time. The tide has turned against them. The game is up. And then once the first blows start to fall, it's obvious they're out. Spencer Percival obviously shot. Robert Peel, the kind of, to some extent, sacrificed his career for what he thought was right. And then number five, Asquith, stabbed in the back by Shyster.
Chamberlain, I would say, is Lord North-esque.
He is
because his entire foreign policy has been torpedoed.
Yes,
and basically, if your foreign policy gets torpedoed and you have humiliated your country, or you've left as prime minister, you've left your country humiliated, then I think you have to go, don't you?
Well, here's the thing. So he's Lord North-esque in another sense because he's Lord North-esque in that the image that everybody has of him now is this sort of weed. This weedy wind.
And his wing collar.
Is completely at variance with the reality at the time. So Chamberlain's taken Britain into the Second World War. Obviously, the policy of appeasement has completely failed, which is your analogy, which is the American War of Independence.
You can imagine how...
Yes, what a bitter blow this is to me.
What a bitter blow this is to me.
Exactly. So he's taken Britain into war with the least ringing, least warlike speech. Vladimir Zelensky, he is not. But... In April 1940, approval ratings, kind of Gallup ratings, are in their infancy. Its ratings are actually very, very good. They're north of 60%.
Was this rallying to the flag, isn't there?
There was a rallying to the flag. There was a sense that Mr. Chamberlain, with his mastery of the accounts...
Which he had done his best, I think.
Yeah, that he had done... Well, I think that was very important. Actually, I think Chamberlain is much maligned. And I think the fact that he had clearly done his best and tried to avoid war meant that Britain went into the Second World War. I know people have huge arguments about aircraft production, but what it definitely meant is that Britain went into the Second World War united with a consensus that we had done everything possible to avoid war. And now we were determined, to wage it and win it, which I don't think would have been the case, actually, if we'd entered war earlier, because there had always been people who said we should have given the Germans more chances. Anyway, what destroys him, his equivalent of Yorktown, is the invasion of Norway, the catastrophic debacle of all these people arriving in Norway with the wrong kit and getting lost in the snow and falling into the sea and fighting among themselves or whatever, while the Germans are kind of carrying all before them. Then we have this sort of shambolic withdrawal from Norway at the end of April 1940. And then on the 7th and 8th of May, there is this. So this is the great debate. This is the sort of, the only parallel for this, I think, is the fall of Margaret Thatcher and the Jeffrey Howe speech, or the Disraeli attack on Robert Peel. So it's the 7th and 8th of May. It's this famous Norway debate that you sort of see immortalized in films and so on. Sir Roger Keyes, the MP for Portsmouth, turns up in his full admiral's uniform and absolutely denounces the government's handling of Norway. Leo Amery gives the famous speech, later
called "The Name of God Go." Is that the one? Yes.
"Depart, I say, and let us have done with you." Later used by The Sun, I think, to describe Bobby Robson, Tom. Anyway, so there's a vote of, this is a
in the name of Allah go, wasn't it?
In the name of Allah go, after we drew with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
I think it was. So, so I'm glad we've got that in. Very important. He had about a 200 majority, Chamberlain, but he won that confidence vote by only 81. And at that point, it was obvious to him and to everybody that with so many people, sort of 120 Tories, either abstaining or voting against, that the game was up. Chamberlain is a very honourable man, and he basically says to his sort of advisors, I will resign unless Labour agree to have a coalition government with me as Prime Minister. Clement Attlee, the Labour leader, consults with the other sort of Labour bigwigs, and they say, no, they won't serve under Chamberlain, but they will serve under somebody else. And Chamberlain, you know, he behaves admirably, actually.
As a patriot.
Exactly, very patriotically. He basically organises the kind of consultation about who will succeed him. On the 10th of May, when he quits, he gives this, actually, when you read it, very moving resignation address, where he says, the whole country must unite around Churchill, his successor. And then Churchill asks him to stay on as Lord President of the Council, which he does. When Chamberlain goes back into the House of Commons, there's a tremendous ovation. I mean, everybody kind of cheers.
Which is
him.
A problem for Churchill, isn't it?
Yes, because actually the Tories are much more.
It's still Chamberlain's party. Chamberlain recognises this, and in the crucial debate between him, Halifax, and Churchill, Chamberlain sides with Churchill.
With Churchill. So Chamberlain actually comes out of this story, I would say, extremely well.
As Churchill recognises.
As Churchill recognises.
And then when Chamberlain dies, he gives that kind of amazing threnody on him. Very moving.
And Churchill offered him the Order of the Garter, said, "Would you?" as he was dying. So he's diagnosed with bowel cancer in August 1914. He dies in November. Churchill says, "Would you like the Order of the Garter?" And Chamberlain says, again, I think quite movingly, he says, "No, I would prefer to die plain Mr. Chamberlain, like my father before me." And so he does.
I once went to a dinner party where we all had to read something that we found moving.
Oh.
This was part of this is what we do in London, Dominic.
Yeah, of course.
And I read Churchill's speech on mourning, you know, commemorating Chamberlain. And the woman next door to me was so infuriated by that she physically assaulted me and threw me off my chair.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to, when you started that anecdote, when you said the woman next to me, I thought, oh, she start crying. But no, with rage.
She was so furious.
Why?
I'm not quite sure. I don't know. I don't know what it was.
Because even if she was anti-appeasement, the fact that Churchill was saying it would surely, well, that's extraordinary.
Maybe she was a committed fan of Lord Halifax.
Yes, maybe.
I don't know. Anyway, so I've always had a soft spot for Chamberlain.
Yeah, quite rightly. I think he's great. There's lots of unlikable things about Chamberlain, but Robert Harris really humanizes him in his book Munich, which was made.
Yeah, I thought the film was very good with Jeremy Irons.
I haven't seen the film, but I imagine Jeremy Irons would be very good as Chamberlain.
Yeah, he was.
Because what people get wrong about Chamberlain is Chamberlain was incredibly he was a man of iron will and incredibly arrogant, sort of man of tremendous self-belief, and not at all this sort of pooterish weed that we now think of him.
Well, he's a man of the Midlands, wasn't he, Dominic?
He was a man of the Midlands. He was like, he was like one of Tolkien's hobbits. Right, Tom. So we've had there's another couple of prime ministers who fall by the wayside in the next few years. So obviously, Eden, ill health.
Well, but interesting, Churchill, who doesn't.
Yeah, so Churchill, people are always going to see
Churchill. So people who've seen The Crown, which you haven't, Dominic, but the opening episode.
No, I have
the
seen
Crown.
The first episode.
Okay,
of The Crown.
It's kind of endless. The political plot in that is people endlessly trying to get rid of Churchill, isn't it?
What are we going to do about Mr. Churchill?
So they're kind of going off and
yes.
Anthony Eden sleeping off in a shooting party with George VI. And
But basically what people are doing to Churchill is sort of constantly saying, Winston, do you not think it's time? You know, the Mediterranean's very... And, Churchill then has another stroke and just refuses to go.
Very Boris.
So actually what that is a reminder of is that a prime minister is very hard to get rid of. if they don't want to go, they can be very hard to get rid of. So Churchill
just refused, particularly if you've just won the Second World War.
Well, yeah, okay, that's.
So
Eden goes because he's gone off to Goldeneye, Ian Fleming's house in Jamaica to.
But he's ill, isn't he?
After the Suez Crisis, his health has collapsed. It's an interesting question about whether people would have tried to force him out had he not resigned. And it's still sort of, I think when he returned after Suez, Eden knew that the tide had turned against him.
He had to go. I think that is the lesson from Walpole through Lord North.
That when the moment
through Chamberlain, that if your whole foreign policy has gone tits up,
We're going to come to an example later on, the Theresa May example, of somebody who stays on basically for a long time. You can be a zombie.
But like a goat who's been bitten by a Komodo dragon.
Okay.
Anyway, and Macmillan is the weirdest one, isn't it? Because he gets told he's got terminal cancer, and then he discovers, oh, no, I haven't. I've resigned. Damn.
Well, I think
hold on, guys.
Macmillan kind of talks himself into thinking this. He's a terrible hypochondriac, Macmillan. So Macmillan... Yes, he wakes up in the night with a terrible pain in his bladder. He can't go to the toilet. He gets a specialist in to see him. I haven't really genned up on Macmillan for this, so I'm doing this from memory. And then he sort of says, oh my God, I'm going to die. I resign.
Do you think he resigned? Do you think he resigned partly because he knew he was going to lose the next election?
Well, this is the thing. You see, the tide has clearly turned against Macmillan. Yeah. It was post-Profumo.
Peter Cook doing the merciless impressions of him and things.
He's been prime minister since 1957, 63. The momentum, the cultural temperature has changed.
He's an interesting example of someone who resigns because of hypochondria.
Yes, I guess so. But also, would he have resigned from hypochondria, Tom, 2 years earlier when he was in his pomp? I would say probably not. I think there's a bit of him that thinks, oh, the game is a sod it, the game's up anyway.
This leads very, very neatly into your next choice. If it's someone who may actually have been incredibly ill, but doesn't resign.
Yeah, Harold Wilson.
So Harold Wilson is your, what's that, eighth?
Well, seventh. He's my seventh choice. Actually, I didn't choose him for 1976. I choose him for the late 60s because he's the one example, actually, of a prime minister who appears to be sunk. But, people always would talk about Harold Wilson as a kind of India rubber man.
But he doesn't resign.
And he doesn't resign.
So
and,
you can't have him for that.
And the constant plots against him, which from 1966 to 1970, the newspapers are dominated by stories about people plotting. And Wilson doesn't resign. So the reason he's my number seven, Tom, is because he's the one who bucks the trend.
No, that's not acceptable.
But I've chosen him.
No, you can only have people who resign. You can't have people who don't.
No, because I think, but then, of course, he does resign in 1976.
Exactly, so that's why I thought you were doing it.
I've surprised you.
He gets Alzheimer's, doesn't he?
I've surprised you. Well, why does he resign in 1976? It's not because he had Alzheimer's.
And he's being bugged by MI5.
And it's not because he always said he would do just a couple of years. He'd always said this. In fact, he didn't expect to win in 1974. But you know how he breaks the news to the Queen, Tom?
No.
They're washing up in a cottage.
Oh, yes.
On her estate.
In Balmoral.
Yeah, I think it's Balmoral. I can't remember.
Yes.
And,
or Sandringham, is it? No, Balmoral.
They're washing up after tea or something, or lunch.
Because the Queen loved him, didn't she?
Queen got on very well with Wilson, yeah. And ever since, people sort of said, no, why did Harold resign? Because they'd had all these plots to topple him in the late 60s. He'd been incredibly unpopular in 1968 after the devaluation of the pound. But here's the thing, and this is, I think, the interesting thing. Why doesn't Wilson fall? Why doesn't somebody move against him? In his case, it's because he stacked his cabinet with what he called crown princes. So Roy Jenkins, James Callaghan, Dennis Healy, Tony Benn, Anthony Crosland, all these kind of big figures, because he knew they all hated each other so much that they would rather keep him on than give their rivals a chance to strike for the crown. And, you know, this is...
I accept that.
The problem for a prime minister is if they have a plausible rival, as Asquith did with Lloyd George... And successor. And
however,
so Wilson is a good way of escaping that trap.
Yes, that's fine. But I still think that is an illegitimate choice.
You're outraged at this choice of Harold Wilson, aren't you?
You should choose him for his resignation.
Reasons. I think the podcast should always surprise people.
Yeah, all right.
I think, you know, when we're not surprising our audience, Tom, when I'm not surprising you.
Well, you have surprised me
with that. Then the spark will die.
I think that the spark will die if you persist in illegitimate lists that break the rules.
All right.
There must be rules, Dominic.
So anyway, he resigned in 1976.
And is that because he has Alzheimer's?
No. I think he resigned because he'd always said he would do 2 years or so to his aides. People didn't believe him because they didn't believe a word Woodrow Wilson said. So he, in fact, had told some of his own cabinet. He'd said, I'll probably go in about a year, I'll go in about 6 months or whatever. But people always said, oh, you can't believe a word Harold says. So when he did do it, they thought there must be something sinister behind it.
And then he has a scandalous resignation honours list.
The Lavender List. The Lavender List. Either written or not written, depending on whom you believe, by his political secretary, Marcia Williams, Lady Faulkner.
Lady Faulkner, yeah. So that's quite, you see, I thought that's why you'd had it, because that's an entertaining resignation.
Oh, it's a very entertaining
by scandal
resignation.
And
Wilson's a great example of somebody who resigns and then basically vanishes. Might as well never have
existed.
He goes
off to the Silly Isles, doesn't he?
Yeah, and people
wears tight shorts.
No, he was wearing the tight shorts before that.
Was he?
Yeah, he was.
Very strong look. Anyone wants to Google Harold Wilson tight shorts?
The shorts, the sort of Boy Scout look. Well, Wilson was a great fan of the Scout. He was obsessed by Boy Scouting. But not, he wasn't obsessed by Boy Scouts. That's the wrong. That's the wrong.
No, he was obsessed by, yes, by giving and nobbing.
Yeah, so he dressed as a Boy Scout when he was on holiday. Right, we've really spiraled off.
Okay.
Let's go to number eight, because Harold Wilson was a shambles.
Obviously, everyone knows what the next one will be. It's Mrs. Thatcher.
Yeah.
We've alluded to her in my brilliant introduction. I think that we should, I mean, people basically know the story of Thatcher.
Do that. Well, I think we should tell it very, very briefly, Tom, because some of our listeners, would you believe, are quite young.
The reason why I don't want to go into this too is because I want to do a whole episode on it.
Not just, I think we should do a week of episodes. Right.
Lots of opportunity for
So Mrs. Thatcher is your, in a way, you can, political time has become condensed. So Walpole's 20 years, for Mrs. Thatcher it's 11 years. Well, or 10 years, because by 1989, I think people are tired of her. They're tired of her abrasive style. There's a first leadership challenge, which everybody forgets, in December 1989 by Sir Anthony Mayer. And she won that by 314-33. And even then, Tom, I mean, this puts Boris's result into context. Even then, people said, oh, that's a very bad blow for the PM. 33 people voted against her. So then Geoffrey Howe resigned, her former chancellor. I mean, there's your point about chancellors and prime ministers and that relationship. He resigned. He gave the resignation speech in the 13th of November, 1990.
As though you're an opening batsman and you find that your captain has broken your bat while you're in the pavilion.
Yeah.
Something like that.
It's like words that. To that effect, anyway.
Yeah.
That was a very nice Geoffrey Howe, though. I enjoyed that a lot.
Thank you.
So Michael Heseltine challenged her. Again, she actually won that first ballot, 204-152.
So that's what, so she's in Paris, isn't she?
At Fontainebleau, yeah.
And it's a kind of G7 conference.
No, it's bigger than that. It's the summit to end the Cold War.
Oh, of course it is. Yes, of course it is. Yes,
Gorbachev's there, and everybody, all there.
Gorbachev, yeah. Yes, they're all there. And she comes out, and John Sargent, who we've already mentioned as a Strictly Come Dancing contender, he's standing there wondering, and she just kind of bustles up behind him, doesn't she? We fight to win.
That's it. I fight on, I fight to win. But of course she doesn't, because she then goes back and the very next to London, the very next evening, all her cabinet kind of troop in to see her. So all these sort of people, Ken Clark, William Waldegrave, John Gummer, Chris Patton.
And John Major, her chancellor, who has a serendipitous bad,
sorry, Tom,
terrible teeth.
People can't see this, but I was pointing aggressively at my teeth.
Yes, you were. You were. So John Major has a kind of diplomatic.
It's got a wisdom tooth
dentistry appointment.
But that's not something you would fake, is it? I mean,
I don't know. I mean,
you think it's like Prince Andrew's COVID, Tom?
Possibly. Possibly. That was the comparison that leapt in my mind as well. So basically, Thatcher goes.
Yeah, even though she'd won that first ballot, she's holed beneath the waterline.
So we'll do her later. But on this theme of bad blood between prime ministers and chancellors, the next big beast to be brought down is, of course, Sir Tony Blair.
Yeah, your friend Tony. So Tony, he's probably sunk from 2005, I think.
Because of the Iraq War.
Yeah, but also, I mean, his majority, which had previously been 167, was slashed to 66.
It's not bad, though, is it?
I mean, I know by Labour Party standards,
three elections.
It's absolutely massive. Don't you think that the
Thatcher thing? So you said that people are bored with her after 10 years, and obviously, you know, lots of people are very fed up with her after about a week.
Yeah,
but her own supporters are kind of fed up with her after 10 years.
Well, the poll tax had alienated so many people.
But I think there's a kind of unwritten rule has come in that 10 years is enough.
I think
people
absolutely.
Often say that. So yeah, obviously in absolutely. America, you know, there's an 8-year limit on the presidency.
Or John Howard in Australia, or
effectively, you know, in British politics, there's a kind of 10-year limit.
I think so.
And Blair had reached that limit.
I think political capital is a diminishing resource. And I think you spend it from the first day in office. It's very hard to replenish. Your majorities, by and large, gradually go down.
But what I would also say about Blair is that he effortlessly remained prime minister for 10 years or whatever, however long it was. And then since then, for prime ministers, being prime minister of Britain has been like kind of riding a bucking bronco.
I think that's true. But of course, he benefits from the fact the economy is incredibly rosy during his time in office. So the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune are very much sort of muffled, if a sling can be muffled, during Tony Blair's time in office. But it's still notable, Tom, that people were happy. God almighty.
His people were happy.
What has Tony Blair got on you? That's what we want to
I just think you should
team up with Alistair Campbell on our sister podcast.
Anyway. I just think that if you compare his premiership with what's followed, it's like the Antonine Age followed by the Age of Rust in the Roman Empire.
The Age of Rust. Well, anyway, listen, we should do How He Fell before you. I mean, you're just getting tearful now.
Yes.
I'll have to stage an intervention like that woman at the dinner party about the Neville Chamberlain speech. So what brings him down, funnily enough, is, and this is, again, much forgotten. In the summer of 2006, Israel went to war against Hezbollah and attacked Lebanon. And there was huge outrage within the Labour Party about this. Blair refused to condemn Israel. He said, you know,
be the wrong thing to do.
Exactly. He said it was, you know, it was a complicated issue, blah, 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 blah. On the 5th of September, 17 Labour Party MPs, including junior defence minister and future Corbyn deputy Tom Watson and 7 parliamentary private secretaries, they sign this letter saying he's got to go. You know, he needs to, because Blair has already basically signed his own political death warrant by saying he won't fight another election. And this letter, I mean, it's only 17 MPs. And actually, your Antonine Age point, I mean, 17 MPs by today's standards, I mean, you know, that's nothing. But at the time, it seems like this sort of great.
It's like the murder of Commodus.
Is it the murder of Commodus?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm just spinning this.
What's that? What's the murder? So the murder of Commodus seems an outrageous event at the time, but later on just seems perfectly normal.
Yeah,
then everyone's getting murdered in the crisis of the third century.
Yes.
All right. So,
but what about the Granita thing? The whole thing, because essentially, Tawny, Blair and Brown are the big allies.
Promise me, Tawny.
Yeah. That's a is that not a factor?
I think it probably
Brown's kind of seething resentment.
Yeah, of course,
it is feeling a factor. That he's owed Downing Street. And that Blair's not sticking by his word.
Blairites would say he could have lanced that boil by just sacking Gordon Brown sometime in his second term, probably, or moving him, or in some way just getting rid of him, and that Gordon Brown wouldn't have had the strength to launch it.
But that is the kind of the classic example of a prime minister and chancellor locked in a kind of death grip.
But Tony Blair probably, it's hard to imagine a scenario in which any prime minister would get more than 10 years. 10 years is a pretty good run.
He is
brought down by his own MPs, but I mean, he was going to go within a couple of years anyway. It's hard to believe that Tony Blair would have fought the 2010 election and won it. Do you not think?
I think he'd have won it.
I don't think he would.
I think his effect on the electorate was like the sirens on Odysseus.
No, I think you think that until they lose. I mean, somebody said when we advertised that we were doing this evening, just before we did it, somebody on Twitter said, would Margaret Thatcher have won the 1992 election?
But everyone hated her. She was abrasive.
I think a lot of people were sick of Tony Blair.
I think they became sick in due course. I think the kind of, the weird thing about Blair was that people, it was kind of the delayed shock of the Iraq War. I mean, he still won the election after the Iraq War.
It did, but, Tom, in 2005, Labour lost, I think, 101 seats. Had they continued to lose at the same rate after a recession at the end of the decade?
You see, I don't think so. I don't think so, because I think, Cameron didn't beat Brown. He didn't decisively beat Brown. He had to have a coalition.
Yeah.
And Brown was, although he did, you know, great things with the aftermath of the crash, I mean, he was not a popular prime minister.
No,
he perhaps wasn't temperamentally suited to the job. So
God, it's like Blair was Peter Mandelson, this
I just think Blair was very I think Blair, actually a bit like Cameron, was temperamentally suited to being a prime minister. People quite like the idea of him as a prime minister. He was kind of, you know, he behaved and looked like people imagine a prime minister should look like.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite an important, anyway.
I think it's very important.
We're spiraling off into a different theme.
Playing the part of being a prime minister is massively important. I completely
agree. And in that sense, Blair is a bit kind of Disraeli's. You know, he's a showman. He's an actor. Yeah. He plays the part. He knows how to tickle the tummy of the electorate.
As I have told the readers of the Daily Mail many times, he's a mountebank.
No, he's an upstanding mountebank.
Well,
anyway,
evangelical mountebank.
So that's Blair goes.
A contradiction in terms. And our final one, number 10, is Theresa May.
Yes.
So the interesting thing about Theresa May is how long she survives, because she has that weird period right at the beginning when she has this incredible honeymoon.
Everyone loves her, don't they?
Her approval rating, she doesn't say anything. She never comes out of her office.
Everybody thinks all she ever says.
Brexit means Brexit. So everybody said, well, I find that very powerful and persuasive. And then she held the election and said that she liked running through fields of wheat, and everybody turned against her. So she loses.
And also she said nothing has changed when everything had changed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's the 8th of June 2017. She lost her majority. I mean, that night when the result came through, people were speculating, will she be gone in days, in weeks? And the extraordinary thing is she survives for almost 2 years. So she goes all the way through to December 2018, and then she has a confidence vote, because the sort of the Tory ultras the successors, I suppose you could say, in some ways, to the ultras who had done for Robert Peel, they force a confidence vote in December 2018, which she wins by 200 votes to 117. And of course, the tremendous irony is that at the time, the Jacob Rees-Mogg and co are queuing up to say,
"Well." So
she has to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the extraordinary thing, the shamelessness of it.
And now Bertie Smog says he was mistaken.
One is enough.
Yes.
Yeah. So I've just got it here. So when that result came through against Theresa May, this is a very bad result for the Prime Minister. 170 votes against her, much worse than she thought. And says that she should resign because the overwhelming majority of backbenchers have voted against her. And now he's saying, one's enough.
Yeah.
One'll do. That's fine.
I think.
What are you fussing about?
I think Jacob Rees-Mogg knows very well that basically there's only one conceivable person
who would ever
give him
have
a job.
Him as a minister.
Yes. Yeah. And that one happens to be the Prime Minister. So she also won a confidence vote in the House of Commons. So that was January 2019. She won by 325 to 306. And I think anyone who remembers this period, well, we all remember it. I mean, this appeared to be a period in which Theresa May was facing confidence votes every 3 days of various kinds. It was either confidence votes or
votes on Brexit.
Meaningful.
Yeah,
votes.
Just awful. I just blanked the whole. Everything
there were,
about it.
There were endless votes on, I mean, for our overseas listeners, there were just endless votes on abstruse and incredibly impenetrable Brexit arrangements in which all were defeated in various combinations.
The kind of angry people from Ulster shouting at her, and just terrible.
So early 2019, she has all these votes, but she lingers on till May 2019. And I think the lesson of that, I mean, there were two lessons. I think one is, as I said, political capital is a diminishing resource. I think when it's gone, you almost never, ever get it back. It's hard to think of. I would say actually Wilson is the only example I can really think of, modern example, of somebody who appeared to lose all his political capital in the late 1960s, but then managed to.
Well, he's in office, but not in power, would you say?
Yes, he's very buffeted by his.
I mean, he's not exactly
Jenkins,
master
Callaghan.
Of what he's
he? He spends an enormous amount of time basically playing political chess with his own cabinet.
Yeah.
And Wilson is a great survivor. He's very wily. He's also a likable. I think that matters, because I think people ultimately don't want to move against him because he's a nice person. So I always say of Harold Wilson, he's the prime minister you'd want as your next door neighbour, to borrow a hose or some such.
Yeah.
But
do the washing up like the Queen.
But yes, exactly. But so political capital diminishes. But the other lesson, I think, is that from Theresa May, or indeed from Tony Blair, actually, is that you can be a long time dying. So even though the game appears to be up,
so
it's quite hard. Gordon Brown would definitely agree with us. It's quite hard to get someone out of number 10 if they don't want to go.
So we're doing this, you know, off the back of the no confidence result against Johnson, which he's won. And we talked about Neville Chamberlain being an honourable man who,
yes,
does the decent thing. I mean, Boris would never do that. I mean, his whole the whole point of his premiership is to be in power. And in fact, for several, you know, for a while now, it seemed like the main purpose of the current government is basically to keep Johnson in power.
No, he's famously on record, Tom, of saying his favourite film is The Godfather Part 2. And
I thought it was Jaws.
Oh, I think he's, how unlike him to have given different answers. But you know, he obviously has this sort of sense of himself as this sort of Michael Corleone figure who will sacrifice.
Well, the big dog. Save big dog, isn't it? Boris's backers have been running this operation. He's the big dog.
Yes, and his opponents wanted to have Operation Rinker to get rid of him. So Rinker, for those of you who don't know, if you should listen to our Jeremy Thorpe podcast, Rinker was a dog cruelly murdered on the orders of the leader of the Liberal Party.
Well, kind of.
1970s.
Kind of. It's a great episode. If you haven't listened to it, do go and get it. Yes. Okay. So do you think that, I mean, the whole basis of this episode is that he's now finished, but maybe he isn't. Maybe he'll stagger on. Maybe he'll win the election. Do you think?
Okay. So I think historians make horrendous political pundits, as everybody knows, who's ever read my columns. But I think 148 of your own MPs against you, I think that's ultimately terminal. Maybe not immediately, but I think it's very hard to go into a general election saying, you know.
So the Thatcher lost Thatcher won a vote of confidence and resigned almost immediately.
She won a leadership election.
May won a vote of confidence, staggered on for 6 months, I think, and then resigned.
Yes.
John Major won a vote of confidence, staggered on, fought the election, and got absolutely murdered in the next election.
He did.
I would reckon that if Johnson doesn't resign, then he will lead the Conservatives to a massive defeat.
Yeah, and
my prognostication, but who, you know, as you say, who knows?
To pick up on your John Major point, Tom, we didn't mention John Major at all, but in July 1995, John Major faced a leadership challenge from John Redwood.
Put up or shut up.
Yes. People may remember that tremendous press conference that John Redwood gave where he was surrounded by people who I think can fairly be described as the more colourful end of the Conservative Party.
Dressed in blazers.
Terrible blazers. Anyway, Major won by a pretty big majority. It was 218 votes, and John Redwood, his challenger, won 89. So a pretty sizable margin. Major's private target, Tom, was 215, so he only beat it by 3. And he decided he would resign if he didn't get 215. But again, Major is, I think it's fair to say, a man with, I mean, not a perfect
more probity,
man,
perhaps,
but a man with perhaps a little more integrity than Boris Johnson. And I say that as I'm not a sort of great Boris hater, but I think it would be very hard for anybody to claim that he was a man, a paragon of virtue.
Well, yeah, and the Corleone comparison. He'd have to be dragged out in a coffin, basically.
I mean, they've got two by-elections coming, which I think they'll lose both of them.
And they're important, aren't they? Because they're one's Red Wall and one is kind of Tory heartlands.
Exactly. So, and I think, you know, especially one of the things that did for Margaret Thatcher was the economy turning against her. She lost control of inflation, interest rates went up, sort of Tory homeowners feeling the pinch. With inflation going up and likely to go higher but by the end of the year, it's very hard to see how things will get easier for Boris Johnson. And, you know, he will make, if I was a Tory party MP, I would think about it this way. He's going to become a very convenient scapegoat a year from now. You dump him, then you get a new leader and you go in saying, well, we've turned a page, you know, we've learned the lessons, all that sort of thing. So I think we could easily be here doing this podcast again.
We can put it out, can't we?
At 10:30. Well, we could put that same podcast.
Yeah.
With the same disagreements about Harold Wilson.
Yeah, we just change it, tweak it a bit at the beginning so people don't notice.
That's a terrible insight into your... I hope the listeners aren't too shocked by that.
But that's the kind of beady-eyed, wheeler-dealing... Ruthlessness. They're head in politics, isn't it?
That's what David Lloyd George would have done.
It is. It's the David Lloyd George option. Right. I think we've done enough. And our poor producers have to go off and lick this into shape.
Yeah. Tom, Tom's going to go and catch up with Love Island.
Yeah, I am. Yeah. And I think we should do the Love Island episode, but we can discuss this.
We definitely should do it. We're so going to do it. And all the extra listeners we would have attracted because of our talk of the Earl of Wilmington. I think they'll stay for Love Island. So, yeah it's win-win.
Let's hope. Okay. All right. Well, thank you for joining this. All very spontaneous, all very exciting. Hope you've enjoyed it. And we will be back on Thursday, won't we, with D'Annunzio, the first fascist.
The first fascist. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.